Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Xuming Qir of the National Immigration Law Center, who assesses the winners and losers in the recently ended government shutdown and the future of the DACA program. Robert Borsaj, co-director of the Campaign for America's Future, who examines the strength and potential of the resistance movement that's developed since Donald Trump's presidential inauguration 1 year ago. And Democratic Party Deputy Chair and Minnesota Congressman Keith Ellison, who talks about reforms undertaken within the party and the need for activists to focus on grassroots engagement. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
In another polarizing policy decision on the Middle East, the Trump administration has frozen $65 million in humanitarian aid to Palestinian refugees administered by the United Nations. The aid funds schools, food aid, and health clinics for 5 million Palestinians living in refugee camps. The Trump administration announced the freeze in reaction to strong Palestinian opposition to Trump's decision to move the U.S. Embassy in Israel to Jerusalem. Shortly after the announcement, the Palestinian Authority pulled out of U.S.-sponsored peace talks. Key members of Trump's foreign policy team, including U.N. Ambassador Nikki Haley and son-in-law and Middle East advisor Jared Kushner, sought a total cutoff of humanitarian aid until the Palestinians returned to U.S.-sponsored negotiations. Currently, the United States pays for 30% of the U.N. Relief and Works Agency for Palestinian Refugees budget, but it will likely face deep cuts with growing hostility from President Trump. Jan Egeland, the head of the Norwegian Refugee Council, called the move politically motivated and warned it would have devastating consequences for vulnerable Palestinian refugees, including hundreds of thousands of children. After a violent civil war erupted in 2013 in South Sudan, the world's youngest nation, 200,000 people sought safety in United Nations refugee camps. Now, 5 years later, the camps have turned into ad hoc cities with police stations, restaurants, churches, a mosque, and a thriving underground economy. In recent decades, cracks in the post-war model of designing refugee camps have begun to show. One after another, what were originally designed to be temporary refugee camps have become de facto, sprawling, permanent cities. The number of people displaced inside their own countries has also been rising, placing an added burden on governments and aid organizations. Michael Castle Miller, executive director of Refugee Cities, a group of experts pushing for new models of urban refugee settlements, proposes that host governments build special status settlements for refugees in urban areas. Under this model, businesses could be given tax breaks in exchange for employing migrants. But others want to create settlements that are more permanent from the outset by having urban planners instead of humanitarians lay out the compounds. They maintain that the needs of a city, such as clean water, electricity, and food, are more easily sustainable than the necessity of having international aid groups economically support temporary refugee camps. Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders laid the groundwork for the next generation of healthcare reform with his advocacy for Medicare for All legislation promoting a single-payer health system. Some Democrats testing the waters for a possible run for president in 2020 have co-sponsored Sanders' Medicare for All bill, including Senators Cory Booker of New Jersey and Kamala Harris of California. Some Democratic Party strategists are looking to find a way to build a bridge from Obamacare to Medicare for All. This includes initiatives to shore up popular programs like Medicare and Medicaid. The healthcare marketplace, a key element of Obamacare, failed on its basic promise to provide access to affordable healthcare for the uninsured. According to the American Prospect, health exchanges cover 12 million people, half of the number originally projected. In contrast, Medicaid exceeded expectations in extending healthcare to millions of working poor families. After Sanders' populist 2016 presidential campaign, there's a growing expectation that Medicare should cover a larger number of Americans who aren't covered by employer-based insurance or public programs like Medicaid. Expanded Medicare coverage could put pressure on hospitals and doctors to lower the costs of care and give the system more leverage to negotiate lower prescription drug prices. But the challenge remains how to provide affordable universal coverage while private, for-profit insurance still dominates America's healthcare system. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
The federal government was shut down for 3 days after Senate Democrats withheld their approval of a short-term spending bill in order to pressure the Republican majority to schedule a vote on legalizing nearly 800,000 Dreamers, recipients of the Obama-era Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals Program, or DACA, who were brought to the U.S. as children by their parents without documentation. But Democrats, facing a possible backlash and vicious GOP attacks, voted to reopen the government on January 22nd after Republican Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell made a vague commitment to bring up DACA legislation for a vote by February 8th, the date the current funding bill will expire and when the government will again face a possible second shutdown. Immigrant rights activists and DACA recipients, many of whom have engaged in civil disobedience protests on Capitol Hill, were angered in what many viewed as a Democratic Party surrender to President Trump and the hardline anti-immigrant Republican agenda. The rage stems from doubts that the Republicans will follow through on their commitment to hold a vote on DACA, which was made necessary when Mr. Trump rescinded Barack Obama's executive order establishing DACA protections on September 5th. Your reporter spoke with Xu Ming Chir, senior staff attorney and field coordinator with the National Immigration Law Center. Here she assesses the winners and losers in the recently ended government shutdown and the future of the DACA program.
I just want to make the point that it is Trump who created this problem, where we're seeing close to 800,000 young immigrants who are protected in the DACA program face the expiration of the program and the loss of their work permits and potential deportation from this country. That was a crisis created by this administration, and Congress has been trying to find a solution that would provide a way for these young people to be able to gain their legal status and eventually become citizens. And so I think we felt fairly optimistic over the weekend as we saw Senate Democrats and even a few Senate Republicans say that this issue of legalization of young people was important enough that they were not going to vote for a continued budget resolution. And this morning, unfortunately, in a very disappointing way, we saw that the Senate did, in fact, end up voting for a continuing resolution to fund the federal government for another 3 weeks until February 8th. And as part of that agreement, there's this vague commitment from the Senate leadership that there would be a vote on the DACA issue in the near future, but we're not clear what that means. There's been many different proposals introduced. Some of them contain very negative provisions, such as additional funding for the border wall, changing family immigration. So we're not sure exactly what it's going to look like if this issue is brought to a vote. And it's very disappointing when the shutdown was really because of the Republicans, and yet we see the Democrats fail to really stand up to them and push forward the agenda that they had told us they would push forward, a very progressive agenda.
As our listeners know, the Democrats are in the minority in both the House and Senate, and the Republicans, of course, hold the White House with Donald Trump. What options did the Democrats have in terms of pushing the DACA vote that they didn't get with this deal to extend funding for the government for another few weeks? What were their options?
Some of their options would have been to refuse to vote for this funding unless a bill to legalize young immigrants was attached. There's been a lot of negotiations about what this would look like, and there's been a bipartisan deal reached in Congress in terms of, you know, who would be legalized, how long it would take, et cetera. And so I think a lot of what Democrats just had to do was to stay strong and hold the line and say that this issue is important enough that they would not vote to keep funding the government unless this issue was part of that agreement.
So what's the response of your organization, the National Immigration Law Center, and other grassroots groups of immigrants' rights activists and the Dreamers themselves,
who have engaged in nonviolent civil disobedience on Capitol Hill very often since this issue has come to a head in recent months.
Right. And, you know, for us and for other immigrant rights groups, the protests, the actions will continue. We saw a lot of people, hundreds of thousands, turn out for the Women's March this past weekend. And many people, you know, connected the issue of immigration as to why they were present at the march. So the work will still continue. The advocacy will still continue. We know that it takes a while to create change. And so we're not going to back down. We're going to continue really pushing our Congress members and other elected officials until we can get the solution that we want.
And maybe you could describe the legal strategy, because I know at least one federal court judge held up any implementation of the Trump administration's directive to end DACA altogether in March, coming up real quick. What can you tell us about the court strategy?
Right. There are several cases proceeding in courts across the country that the cases were filed saying that Trump's actions in ending the DACA program were unconstitutional. And one of the main goals is to really keep the DACA program around as long as possible so that people can still renew their DACA and get their work permits for another 2 years and still have that protection from deportation. So because of an injunction or a block on the administration's decision to end DACA, there is a window right now where people can still renew their DACA. And that was one of the goals of these lawsuits, to make sure that people would have that continuity with their DACA and not face all the imminent risks and problems that people face when they become undocumented.
That was Xiuming Qir, senior staff attorney and field coordinator with the National Immigration Law Center. Find more views on the DACA debate and learn about the Law Center's work by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. When Donald Trump defied polls and expectations to defeat Hillary Clinton and win the White House in the November 2016 election, millions of people across the U.S. reacted with shock and disbelief. The confused and angry emotions that followed Trump's Electoral College victory and popular vote defeat attracted many to find catharsis in joining the January 21st Women's March the day following Trump's inauguration. In fact, the Women's March, where more than 4 million people rallied in over 650 cities across the U.S., became the largest national political protest in U.S. history. 1 year after Trump took office, and with his popularity plummeting due to his administration's unpopular right-wing policies, erratic behavior, and the ongoing investigation into Russia's involvement in his 2016 campaign, another set of Women's March events succeeded in attracting upwards of 2 million participants in hundreds of cities and towns. However, this year's actions reflected the success of local organizing efforts that brought together people working on a variety of issues over the past 12 months, including groups organizing for racial justice, immigration, healthcare, disability, reproductive, and LGBTQ rights, gender equality, and the environment. Your reporter spoke with Robert Borisage, co-director of the Campaign for America's Future, who examines the strength and potential of the national resistance movement opposing Donald Trump's presidency and the Republican Party agenda as the nation prepares for the critical 2018 midterm elections.
Well, I think it's a kind of wonderful outpouring of citizen energy and of obviously the energy of women, and but not just women, of men as well. And I think you've seen it reflected in these kind of by-elections we've had, where the Trump victory and this very extreme right-wing Republican Congress and its distorted priorities has now sparked not just a resistance, I think, but an energy for taking back the country and changing the direction of it that is very hopeful at this point, and I hope continues to build. One of the things about this recent shutdown in the DACA dispute is I would hope that the Democratic Party and independent people put real resources into helping Latinos get registered to vote and organized and mobilized to vote in the fall. These people have to pay a price for these politics, and that comes from people of conscience. It comes from the people who are the direct targets, as with women and people of color and young people, and that mobilization is really vital this fall. Historically, it is exactly that part of the Democratic vote: young people, people of color, single women, who tend to fall off and not vote in large numbers in off-year elections when there's not a president at the top of the ticket. And if they come out in large numbers this fall, Democrats have a decent chance of taking back the House and even a distant chance of taking back the Senate. And that will make a huge difference in what kind of the next years we'll see in terms of the horrors of the Trump years.
Robert, since the 2016 presidential election, there's been a lot of concern about divisions within the Democratic Party between the Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton wing, between the progressive activists and the establishment tied to corporate money and such. Where do you see the Democrats now? And does it really matter in terms of electoral politics and the energy that's out there with these new groups that have been organizing coast to coast? Does what happens in the Democratic National Committee matter much in terms of how well opponents of Trump and the Republican agenda do in the midterm elections?
Well, Democrats desperately need a huge debate about what the party is for and what it stands for. The Sanders-Clinton debate in the primaries was an example of that. And essentially, the establishment of the party has failed. It's failed in policy terms. 8 years of Obama, and we have the most extreme inequality. We're still involved in seven wars. This economy has not worked for the vast majority of Americans. And it's failed in political terms, with Democrats losing 1,000 offices in state legislatures and control of the House and the Senate and eventually the presidency. This is the time when Democrats ought to be voting and progressives ought to be demanding a change in direction, a change in control, and be challenging sitting Democrats who are not with the change. And so I think that insurgency is not only necessary, but it's inevitable and important. What's interesting about, you know, all of the hand-wringing, the establishment immediately starts hand-wringing about divisions, because divisions will weaken us in relationship to Trump, et cetera. But the reality that we've seen with our own eyes over the last year is the Democratic House and Senate, because of the mobilization, has been more unified than one would have ever expected in resistance to Trump. In defending Obamacare and fighting against the tax cuts and fighting on and unified and standing up for the DACA kids. And that wouldn't have happened without the kind of mobilization we've had. And then the reality is that primary fights and a real mobilization of energy and insurgent candidacies, sure, it sometimes leads to upset victories and oddball candidates that put seats at risk that might otherwise be won. But in fact, for the most part, it mobilizes new energy. It gets people out to vote.
A lot of political observers talk about how Democrats, in opposition to Donald Trump and the Republican Party, need more than opposition to Trump and his agenda to have an effective electoral strategy, that they have to be for something and not just against something. If you were to take a stab at a unified message that really could work to attract a lot of different people to opposition candidates in the 2018 midterm elections, what would it look like?
Well, I think the kind of core question that too seldom gets addressed is what's the agenda that makes this economy work for working people? How do we empower workers to capture a fair share of the profits their companies make? How do we limit the shipping of jobs abroad? How do we crack down on these tax havens and scams that are skewing our economy? How do we create shared security programs that in fact give people the ability to go through their lives and take risks and build secure families? And that agenda has to be more populist in the face of Trump. It has to be more hard-hitting. It has to take on the big money that has corrupted the Democratic Party. I think Democrats ought to have a message that makes it clear they are the party of reform. The other piece of that is we can't continue to pretend we're going to police the entire world. We need a defense policy that keeps us secure but doesn't keep us involved in endless wars without victories.
That was Robert Borisage, co-director of the Campaign for America's Future. Find a link to his recent Nation magazine article titled "The Orange Menace and the Even More Dangerous Party That Stands With Him," and related analysis of the resistance movement by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Keith Ellison, who represents Minnesota's 5th Congressional District, was an enthusiastic supporter of Bernie Sanders' 2016 run for president. And Sanders, in turn, supported Ellison after the election in his bid to chair the Democratic National Committee. However, Ellison lost to former Obama Labor Secretary Tom Perez, who was supported by Hillary Clinton. But in an attempt to bring the party together, he was appointed the party's deputy chair. Over the past year, both men have been crisscrossing the country, trying to rebuild a divided Democratic Party. Ellison appeared at an event in New Haven, Connecticut in mid-January, speaking to a full house at a local sanctuary church, which is currently hosting an Ecuadorian immigrant fighting to remain in the U.S. after being ordered deported. In what Ellison called a community conversation, he addressed both those in the audience he knew were lifelong Democratic activists, as well as those who don't identify with that label, but were interested in hearing what a progressive Democrat had to say about the state of the nation and the party. His talk focused on the Democrats' new organizing model and the process of reforming the party's primary election rules. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus attended Ellison's talk and brings us the following excerpts.
What I'm here to ask you to do, as the folks who are the most motivated, the folks who attend meetings, the folks who volunteer and organize, we're asking you to help us revamp, revitalize, and reestablish the Democratic Party as an instrument for social and economic uplift for working people. That's the invitation. Some of you all have been lifelong Dems, and you've been working hard forever. There's never been a moment when you weren't fighting for the people under the umbrella of the Democratic Party. Now, there might be others of you, though, who believe in all the values that we talk about, but you might think, look, I'm gonna spend my time working in this other group, or working in my union, or working in Indivisible, or working in our revolution. And I'm here to tell you, this is awesome. We need, it's not so much a matter of what party or what group you work with, is that you are working, engaging neighbors all over New Haven and Connecticut to make sure that they know they are a part of our Democratic small D family. So this is a project that the Democratic National Committee has. It's called Winning with Partners. What do we mean by winning with partners? What we mean is that we have got to all come together. You go ahead and volunteer for Indivisible. We're glad you're working with your union, but at the end of the day, we all have got to take our part of knocking the doors, of making the calls, of having the meetings in the churches and the mosques and the synagogues, of working in the VFW halls, and we have got to organize our people all over this country. The Democratic National Committee has changed its mission. You know, up until February, we had one kind of mission, which we have shifted. Our mission used to be to re-elect a Democratic president. Now, if we only re-elect a Democratic president, then you see us get busy when? Around the presidential election, which happens what? Every 4 years. What happens to the city council, to the state legislative races? What happens to the county commission? What happens to the judges? Well, we just really weren't in that fight over the last decade. We are changing the model, we have shifted the model, but change sometimes is perceived as a lagging indicator. Sometimes you may change and decide to change something, but it takes a while before people really see it. So I'm telling you that this is the new spirit of the Democratic National Committee, which is to one, focus on grassroots engagement, two, focus on not just television, but putting money on the ground through training, through engagement of all kinds, to not just work on the presidential, but work on every single level of government. We fight all for every up and down the ballot, not just the top of the ballot, but throughout the ballot. That we understand that for many people, the election is not the most important thing, but it's what happens between the elections. Because it is between the elections that we pass the ordinance for zero waste, that we protect the right to organize in a labor union and fight off these right to work for less statutes. It's between the elections that students figure out, can I afford to go to school or not? It is between the elections where the action happens, and that's what most people really, really care about.
Ellison was and is a big supporter of Senator Bernie Sanders. He noted that in 2016, the Clinton wing of the party had put its, quote, thumb on the scale in the primaries to get an unfair advantage at the convention.
There is a memorandum executed in August 2015 where one candidate got to choose the communications and other staff and others didn't. That's not fair. And so my thing, having acknowledged that fact, is what are we going to do now? So Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders agreed to have a unity commission. That commission has met several times. December 5th, they had some major meetings and came out with recommendations to cut the number of superdelegates by about 66%, to push state parties to have more open primaries. It ought to be a very short timeline. In New York, you gotta be registered to vote for the primary like 6 months ahead of time. That's too long. We need to make it a lot easier to participate. And there are a number of other reforms, including budgetary openness, and so we are on the reform trail. We know that part of the reform of the Democratic Party is transparency, accountability, and integrity.
That was Democratic National Committee Deputy Chair and Minnesota Representative Keith Ellison. For more analysis and commentary on challenges facing the Democratic Party, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WLSL in St. Leo, Florida, WGRN in Columbus, Ohio, KMUD in Garberville, California, and more than 50 other community stations across the U.S. and abroad. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.